Thanks, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Bob. And thanks to the organisers for inviting me. The talk I'm going to give really, Bob, could have given 100 times. In fact, I may have even stole most of it from. Biopta very much came from following in the footsteps of Carnegie. At the time, as Bob said, they were the first company in the world to really focus on human tissue assays for drug discovery, drug development. And I, as an academic, was spending most of my time working for pharmaceutical companies doing similar type of work, and it just seemed to me natural to move the academic work into the commercial sphere, very naively thinking that would be pretty easy, and it wasn't. So Biopta was born in 2001. Part of what I'm going to discuss today is really just taking you through some of the assays that we carry out. Biopta was actually based on a new technology, a new non-imaging instrumentation patent that we had launched, that we now have gone on to build the instrument that exists. It costs a lot of money to do so, but I'm not going to talk about it today. So, again, this first slide very much been covered, so I won't spend too much time on it. The animal tissue argument, we know that it's used extensively. It just is, and it's convenient, it's cheap, and it's fast. But in my experience, and again, in my personal experience, it generally is a poor predictor. I understand what you're saying about subcutimal, etc. My early experience, and in my later experience working with commercial clients, the annual data that comes to us tends to bear some resemblance, some type, but often no resemblance whatsoever to the ultimate human data. It surprises me still. So that's one thing. It's generally a poor predictor. But more specifically, I would argue personally that animal-derived preclinical data is a poor predictor of the clinical trial event, generally. Now, I'm not going to speculate on these things. Other people smarter than me have speculated on whether or not there's a correlation between an over-reliance on animal data and these problems that industry are suffering, late-stage failures, post-registration withdrawals, declining discovery pipelines. I mean, one anecdotal story was the very early days of the Vioxx compound class effect. We were working on those things, and we were doing human tissue assays, and there were responses in human tissue assays that would suggest downstream problems with a drug like Vioxx. Again, anecdotal from my own experience. Now, this is, as everyone knows, the development cycle. In my opinion, animal tissues have a role. They are fast, they are cost-effective. There are a number of validated assays, and that's important. And potency and efficacy studies are very useful. At this stage, at the identification of the lead, where I think Biopta and Pharmagene and Astrand, etc., come in is in the lead selection area, where human tissues can certainly come in, help companies decide which of their small group of leads is probably most likely to be successful in the clinic. And I would argue that when you get to safety pharmacology preclinical development, what we want in an ideal world is a humanized way of getting these assays. We don't have all the assays available at the moment, but in an ideal world, that's what we would be looking for. So I'm going to run through some of the sort of assays. I know for many of you this is very well known, but let's just see if I can pop some new things into it. My interest is, as Bob said, is human tissue, isolated human tissue, living human tissue. Now, what do I mean exactly by that? I mean not cells, not cell lines, not cell types, not primary cells or secondary cells, but groups of cells together forming a working tissue. And it's the importance of the interaction between the different cell populations that I think is important. Now, again, Bob's absolutely right. Tissue does not tell you everything about the whole organism, but it takes you a hell of a way along the road. And it's not just the interaction between different cell populations, different phenotypes, different genotypes. We are moving towards a world of personalized medicine, one way or the other, and the change in paradigm for drug discovery, particularly in the biologics, sort of lends itself to this approach. So we take tissue, expose your candidates to it, and then what you measure then is not the measure of, it's not a pathway, it's not a response of a cell, it's this integrated response of all these cells working together, communicating. It's a kind of black box effect, I guess. We were in a homeopathic store the other day, one of these Jan de Vries stores, and the lady was saying, well, you know, does it matter what the drug does? At the end of the day, the patient feels better. Do we really need to understand that? And I'm not saying that's what he said. But this idea of the integrated response, the fact that it does what you want the drug to do, at the end of the day, that's what we're interested in. So you take the tissue, you add the drug, and you do assays for efficacy, potency, sensitivity, or target. And it's no way comprehensive, but there is a growing range of different tissue types, different assays. Bob touched on some that are available, different tests that are available. So let's just go through some of these. The bread and butter of Biopta, I think, to be fair, is blood vessel work, cardiovascular work. We do lots of other systems and talk with some, but we started with an expertise in cardiovascular and respiratory, and that still remains probably 40 to 50% of our income. And large blood vessels available during all sorts of surgeries. Small blood vessels available via surgery, but via a biopsy program, I'll talk about that in a moment. And it allows you to choose site-specific vessels depending on what you're interested in. If you're interested in developing drugs for heart failure or ulcerative colitis, for example, you may want to look at cardiac gut mucosa. If you're interested in an off-target effect for a particular class that you're aware of and you're developing a compound in that class, then you may be looking for existing known side effects like blushing, for example, and you want to do cardiovascular studies to examine that. And of course, you may be interested in delivery, and the study of cerebral blood vessels for blood-brain barriers is probably one of our further stage research developments. My expertise is in small artery research. Now, these came to the fore, and I was fortunate just to be developing my science as the techniques that allowed us to study these vessels became available. So these are blood vessels that are around the diameter of a human hair, so absolutely tiny, require specialised techniques. We essentially have miniaturised existing pharmacological studies. We've taken these tiny 40 micron wires, put them through the rings of blood vessels, and use standard strain gauge technology to measure relaxation and contractile responses. We know that these small arteries are the primary regulators of blood flow in the body. Large blood vessels from the aorta all the way down to the blood vessels of your big toe don't do very much but transport blood around the body. It's these small blood vessels that actually alter blood flow, alter resistance, control blood pressure. They're ubiquitous, they're everywhere, and they're every organ, of course. And the beauty of them, and from a commercial viewpoint, why we focused on them so much was you can obtain many blood vessels from a very small biopsy. The standard skin biopsy that we use is about the size of a fingernail. It's very, very tiny. And as well as this strain gauge technology, you use pressure flow systems, which add certain advantages. So here's perfusion studies. Here's an isolated blood vessel, cannulated at both ends. This allows you to perfuse through the compound of the drug through the lumen of the tissue. And clearly this is where most drugs will end up, in the lumen of the blood vessels. So this allows interluminal delivery. We know that there's an increased sensitivity in this technique, around 10 times if you add the drug through the lumen than if you add it around the outside. It allows you to compare the difference. You can add the drug to the outside or the inside and see what difference that would make. So you're comparing endothelial smooth muscle effects. We can use automated standardized technology now to do this at a higher throughput, clearly not a throughput that you can get in cell culture, but certainly at a higher throughput. And it's an extraordinarily useful technique. Currently we're using it to test delivery regions for RNAi. As you know, one of the hopes of RNAi is that it will become the next sort of blockbuster class. The problem is delivery. How do you get it into the tissues? For macular degeneration, applying it straight into the eye is fine. But if we ever want it to become a systemic drug, we need to start looking at delivery agents. And viruses are never going to be accepted. So we can use this technique to see if the reagents themselves, and you would be surprised at the world's best known reagents that are used in cell culture, that are actually toxic to at one level to human blood vessels. So that's kind of useful for it. These blood vessels, again, this is a small 200 micron tune resistance artery. They're highly innervated. It surprises people that this level of nervous control exists within these tiny blood vessels. So therefore you can use them to measure vascular sympathetic tone, and we can generate an electrical field across them and get the nerves to release their catecholamines, whether it's, depending on the site of the blood vessel, different catecholamines. components. And you can use this for neuroplasticity studies, or for example diabetic, if you're interested in diabetes, for neuropathy studies. So field stimulation assays. Vascular profiles is something that we've been doing quite a bit of recently, where the company's really interested in their compound. Generally, does it? They're interested in developing a compound for a completely different therapeutic area from cardiovascular, but they want to know, does it have any cardiovascular effect? Now, if you take small resistance arteries from skin, skeletal muscle, and from the gut, you're really covering quite a large volume of the blood, the total blood flow. So you can do this sort of vascular profile. Now, we can get in a good biopsy around 20 small arteries, depending on the source of the biopsy. And the beauty of this is that you can study both control and patient groups. Let me give you an example. It's a kind of surrogate phase 2 study that we carried out. So here we have postmenopausal women with diabetes. The client was introducing an HRT, a new hormone replacement therapy. Of course, the interest is, does hormone replacement therapy increase cardiovascular risk? Diabetics already have increased cardiovascular risk, and postmenopausal women have increased cardiovascular risk, and needs to synergize to provide that, to increase that. So what we did is we took small biopsies from the recruited patients before they were given the drug, and then we repeated the biopsy prior to. These are small skin biopsies from the hip region. We also can take tissue from control patients. You pay patients for control tissue, for control biopsies, and you have to pay their tax as well, if anyone's interested. So here's the data, and what we show is normal healthy age match controls. You get a normal response to acetylcholine, which is essentially a marker of vascular health. It's an endothelium-dependent relaxing agent. Prior to HRT, or postmenopausal diabetics have this impaired response, which is well known in the literature that the vascular health declines. And then after a period on the HRT, we repeated biopsy in the same patients, and that's the power of this. You're not re-recruiting different patients. You're taking the same patient that you did the original biopsy in, and we saw this improvement in response. Now, this type of study, where you take two biopsies, can be extended to longitudinal studies. You can take a patient back a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later. My argument has always been that the clinical trial process is very short term. And we've seen that with biopsies and other drugs, where often the problems don't really arise. A lot follow downstream, and the causes of the downstream problems can very often be very small, very tiny, sensitive changes that you won't pick up during clinical trials. So this idea of longitudinal studies picks up these chronic changes. Vascular permeability, many drugs are interested in how does it affect permeability across membranes. You can perfuse vessels with substances. The way to do this in vivo is you take an animal, a rat, you inject it with Evans dye, you kill the animal, and then you look at the tissues and you see how that dye has escaped from the vascular compartment. This is a sort of surrogate method of doing that. Human blood vessels, you inject the dye through the lumen. Here we have, here you have the start, the baseline. Here you have a time control, and here you have a time control with thrombin. Now, it doesn't show up that well on this particular slide, but color outshade analysis allows you to quantify this, and you can essentially get a measure of how your compound is altering permeability, vascular permeability in these tissues. Angiogenesis is a big area, clearly in tumour growth, but also in other diseases, retinopathy again in the diabetes area, and therapeutic strategies are being developed by companies for both pro and anti-angiogenic purposes. Now here what you do with the small blood vessels is you combine them with culture techniques, this organoculture technology, and there's a range of different ways you can do this. You're looking at tissue response to angiogenic drugs. You can take sections of tissue, keep them in 96 well plates, look at them at various time points. This example here is an anti-angiogenic treatment where the increase in concentration is reducing this endothelial sprouting that you see here. And of course, you analyse it just using standard light microscopy. And this type of study is well suited to target selection and lead optimization studies. Adverse effects, Bob talked about sinotriptan. We know what a lot of drugs do. We have in human tissues, what's been going on for decades, with lots of information. You can call these reference compounds if you want. We know what sinotriptan does. We know what serotonin does. You give us your compound and we'll tell you how it compares to these non-reference compounds. Again, standard concentration response type studies. So moving from vascular to respiratory, again, the area of expertise for both the former speakers here, so treading in dangerous ground. From my perspective, what I can tell you is it's technically extremely difficult. The respiratory system, a low-pressure system, very fragile tissue, you need to get from often this type of tissue to isolated bronchial tree or isolated airways. And getting from here to here requires specialist skills and techniques. Tissue is very easily damaged. But if you are skilled in the art, it allows you to do quite interesting studies on, for example, changes in airway tone and application of compounds. The parenchymal tissue itself does have physical properties. It's elastic. You can use strips, you can use strain gauge technology to study in that. And it also lends itself to nerve stimulation studies, again using the same field stimulation approach I described earlier. And again, often we're asked to do this kind of study for companies who aren't interested particularly in respiratory physiology. Their therapeutic area is different, but they want to know that there's no respiratory issues that may get into respiratory delivery methodology. Again, similar to Paul's talk, you can do in vitro allergy models here. We can take tissue, isolated human airways here. We can do a response of the airways to standard beta agonist, isoflurane. And then we can see what happens when you sensitize that. Here, the tissue has been incubated with immunoglobulin, and you see that it reduces the response to isoflurane. Similar approach, take two airway rings in the same patient, do a controlled contraction to acetylcholine, and then incubate one in normal serum, and incubate the other in serum from atopic serum from patients who develop very powerful allergic responses. And you can see that the tissue that's incubated in the atopic serum responds quite badly to house dust mite application. So you get constriction, airway constriction. So again, a fairly standard, typical airway response that can be done in vitro and human airways. We can look at cardiac tissue, and the most common source of cardiac tissue, the easiest source at the moment, is the atrial appendage. This is a little kind of flap-like appendages at the end of the atria, removed during cardiovascular surgery for the application of the tubes that connect you to the perfusion machine. So during bypass surgery, these atrial appendages are removed and thrown away. You can collect these atrial appendages, and what's wonderful about them is you can access trabeculi, which are these round muscular columns that exist throughout the cardiac tissue. And the trabeculi give similar inotropic and chronotropic characteristics to cardiac muscle. So in a close-up of the trabeculi, you see this column. So isolated trabeculi can be studied, they beat spontaneously, you can measure cardiac contractility, and the other good thing about the atrial appendages is they are abundant in the coronary microarteries, so taking you back to the resistance archer studies. Again, technically difficult to remove, to set up, but in the correct hands they become a very valuable assay. Here's just real data trace from trabeculi study where you have this beating effect, this contraction relaxation over a time period. You can add a vagal parasympathetic neurotransmitter, you can inhibit this, and then you can add a catecholamine and get it to respond again. So you can mimic to a certain extent cardiac responses in this isolated tissue. Now, it's similar in a way to HERG testing. HERG testing is regulated and required by FDA. This isn't, but it can give you just as valuable information, certainly as along with HERG testing, extremely valuable. So we don't have to just look at contractile tissue, or you know, tissue that generates a force. You can look at tissue sheets, skin, respiratory, gastrointestinal, particularly glands lend themselves to this type of study. In these types of assays, we tend to add compound to one surface of the tissue sheet and then make a measurement at the other surface, and maybe you're looking at absorption, secretion, and maybe that you're looking at electrochemical changes. This is an old technology that really should have been used more often, the Usine chamber. And essentially, it's a sealed system. You can add your compound to, let's say, skin in this instance. The compound passes through both epidermis and dermis. The amazing thing now is you can actually produce humanized skin. I know this touches on stem cells and various other issues, that what is it valuable, and we can discuss that afterwards. There are a number of companies now, mostly in the United States, who are producing from fibroblasts and keratinocytes, are producing very, very skin-like material. There was a presentation at RNAi in Europe a few weeks ago that L'Oreal are using a similar assay to this on their cosmetics. And I have an open mind. It certainly seems to have phenotype and morphology similar to human skin. Whether or not that translates into very detailed its usefulness in drug discovery, I'm not 100% sure, but in terms of toxicology and inflammatory screens, it seems to be fairly useful. I haven't tried it myself, so I can't speak for it. One of the beauties of these this approach of using skin is, of course, in the cosmetic industry. The European laws changed recently, the use of animals in cosmetics and cosmetics and toiletries, as well as pharmaceuticals can make use of skin as a human tissue, and Paul mentioned that it's very easily available. The weird thing about the increase in business through cosmetics is the increase in the availability of tissue through cosmetic surgery. There's an irony there that I smile at sometimes quietly to myself, but the amount of skin available from cosmetic surgery is actually it's fairly vast. So you can look at things like side effects through transepithelial drug transport, medial transport diffusion. If it's gut tissue you're looking at, you can look at absorbance through mucous membranes. Well suited to skin application. The study of sodium potassium transport across sweat glands is one of the key areas of research for developing antiperspirant medication. For example, Unilever spend a large amount of money on sodium potassium studies every year. Again, for inflammation, you can use these studies. Again, the inflammation is associated with delivery formulation, and Paul touched on these microtiter assays that you can do in vivo, which are absolutely valuable and very, very powerful. You can do that sort of stuff in vitro as well, and maybe if you're not interested in delivery formulation, you're interested in an actual pathological inflammatory response, for example, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's, etc. And so you can look at other tissues, gut mucosa, synovium, adipose tissues. You can use strain gauge technology along with these sheets. Some particular members, particularly in the gut, you have physical characteristics. Don't have to have muscle available to have physical responses. You can measure the release of mediators, particularly in this closed chamber system, where you can add a compound to one side and measure the release of substances on the other, endogenous release. Histamine, prostaglandins, cytokines, for example. Coupling the physiological technique with radioimmunoassay, for example. And there's a big area now in pro-inflammatory cytokines and trying to inhibit them. I'm sure Astrand and Biopta and other competitors are working on developing the best assays for this area. It's an enormously important area. The cytokine storm issue certainly raised the awareness of the importance of cytokine pathways. The study of cytokines is incredibly complex. In Edinburgh, we've just opened up a department of pathway medicine. Peter Gazal is trying to tease out using bioinformatics and all sorts of computing in silico models. And just that one small pathway, that one enormous pathway, cytokine pathway, is incredibly challenging. So, the question of will in silico modeling, mathematical modeling, it will one day, I absolutely agree with Bob, we're definitely moving in the right direction. But the challenge and the scale of the challenge, we can model pathways, but the interaction between these pathways is absolutely enormous. And now with the jumping a little bit, and trademark talk, now with the knowledge that we have on microRNA and the effect on altering phenotypes and things like jumping genes, etc., the complexity of our of trying to map a physiological pathway is really, really staggering. Hopefully we'll get there. And then finally, neural tissue. And this, I would say, is probably the future for companies like Biota, and we are not anywhere near where we should be in developing the assays for neural tissue that that we need to be. You could argue that animal tissue really is the way to go just now, neural tissue, because it's really available. It's difficult to access neural tissue from humans, but it can be done. Neural tissue has still been removed for the treatment of epilepsy, for example, and in cancer. So you can still access human tissue, but what doesn't exist are good validated assays that correlate to, you know, these main diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, psychosis, depression, and a lot of us are looking at developing these kind of assays. There are assays available to study brain slices. You can do electrophysiology on neurons, again using similar stimulation electrodes to, you know, similar to the field stimulation approach, but this time using point-to-point stimulation. And we can measure radio-labeled neurotransmitters. There have been successful assays carried out in hippocampus tissue and hypothalamus and the cortex, but these are done in academic centres and are not really available commercially yet. And then my own interest in blood-brain barrier, trying to develop assays which really model human blood-brain barrier. I would argue they don't exist yet, but we're getting close to being able to study the vascular tissue and the astrocyte relationship in primary human tissues. But the technical difficulties in getting the tissue that size, we will get it. Just the last slide. This is what I would like to see happening. I don't know if it will happen. Changes in legislation should have made it better. Along with Pharmagene at the time, we were hoping, and we were part of the discussion process, and we hoped it would make it better. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with the Human Tissue Act, but Scotland took a different approach. We did not like the word consent, which may tell you something about the Scots. So we changed the word consent to authorisation. Because if someone consents to something, basically they're consenting to what's specifically detailed in the terms of the document they're consenting to. If they authorise it, then they're basically saying, we don't really understand it, which is the Scottish argument, is that most patients don't really understand what's going to happen to the tissues, but okay, we trust that you're going to put it to good use and authorise your use. So that gives us a bit of flexibility, which was good. On the negative side was the Human Tissue Act in England and Wales covered both cadaveric tissue and living tissue. The Human Tissue Act Scotland only covers cadaveric tissue. In terms of living functional human tissue, we still act under guidelines. The Human Tissue Authority carry out services for Scotland, but we are under different legislatory and regulatory rules from them. So there are differences there. So with that, I'll finish. I don't know if I'm...